It's a great pleasure to be here at Perimeter Institute, and I want to thank, of course, Céline and Luca for the invitation to speak. So the goal of my talk is to try to understand to which extent we can understand quantum gravity in four-dimensional asymptotically flat spacetime, which are spacetime which have vanishing cosmological constant lambda. And it's never a bad thing to remind that these classes of spacetimes are extremely relevant for a huge amount of purposes in physics, from collider physics to astrophysics, as long as we are describing systems which are smaller than cosmological scales, because we know we live in a De Sitter universe, but taking lambda to zero is actually an excellent approximation for many, many purposes. So another motivation I have for this program is actually to understand this monster we have in the center of galaxies, namely supermassive black holes or black holes in general. And I think it's fair to say that somehow our understanding of quantum properties of black holes is really tight with the extremely powerful advances we have made thanks to the holographic or ADS-CFT correspondence. And as such, this formula, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of black hole, can be seen as one of the primordial holographic relationship, because it's telling you that the entropy doesn't scale with the volume of the black hole, but rather with the boundary of its volume, namely the area. And the thing is that if we want to describe realistic black hole solutions, such as the one we see in the sky, we really have to go beyond the ADS-CFT correspondence, because these realistic solutions, basically the Kerr metric, do not possess an ADS, an anti-De Sitter near horizon region, nor are they asymptotically ADS. So if we want to have a quantum understanding of this object, we better have, it's really urging us to have a holographic description for asymptotically flat spacetimes. So that's one of the motivation for this talk is to, we have this holographic principle that we understand pretty well for spacetime which are anti-De Sitter, which is telling us that quantum gravity is actually, can be described in a different theory that lives at the boundary of that spacetime. And an important question is to see to which extent this paradigm is generic, namely doesn't just apply to anti-De Sitter, but instead is a sort of a general paradigm for quantum gravity. And to do that, we need to understand this principle beyond the canonical cases. And as I said, in this talk, I will be focusing on the case where the holographic dual to flat spacetime is largely unknown rather than ADS, where we understand there is a conformal field theory at the boundary. Here, basically, we do not really understand what is the analog of the dual theory. So in recent years, well, actually, very early, some time ago, very soon after Maldacena's paper on ADS-CFT, there have immediately been people trying to generalize this or to extend to use this for flat spacetimes. There were a bunch of works in this direction. And now I think that we can say that the main difficulties, I think for me the two main problems, if you want, or two main difficulties we need to circumvent are the following. The first is that the boundary of flat spacetime, here in this Penrose diagram, this null surface, future null infinity, is a null hypersurface, rather than in ES, where we have a nice time-like boundary. And the second point is that there are fluxes which are escaping through the boundary, whereas in ADS, we typically have some reflective boundary condition. And that's why we say that sometimes we put quantum gravity in a box. So this is the picture that describes quantum gravity in ADS, but rather for flat spacetime, what we have to deal with is rather this kind of a picture. So in recent years, there have been two natural proposals for a holographic description of flat space. The first one is what you might naively want to do is to try to formulate and look at the boundary, which is this null hypersurface scry, null infinity. But in recent years, there have been a different proposal for what is the holographic screen to look at, what is the most natural thing to look at. And this is in terms of now the celestial sphere, which is a really a 2D, two-dimensional boundary in this case. In the first case, you will do a sort of co-dimension wall type of holography, where the dual theory will have to carry the symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetime, namely the Bondi Messner-Zach symmetries, or equivalently the conformal Kaolian symmetries, as Romain explained earlier on this week. In the second proposal, the dual theory is supposed to live on the celestial sphere, and this is called a celestial conformal field theory, whose full properties we do not yet understand, but we are actively trying to get at that. So both of these paradigms have different advantages and disadvantages. For instance, here it's a bit more looking like ADS-CFT in the sense that it's a co-dimension one type of duality. Well, here the whole purpose of recasting everything on the sphere is to really exploit the huge amount of techniques we have been developing for conformal, usual two-dimensional conformal field theories. But the price to pay somehow is that there is always a price to pay, and here is the fact that because you are reducing one extra dimension, the one a long time, then the role of translation is become obscure in a CFT language. And as Romain argued, actually, these two approaches are not irreconcilable nor incompatible. There is actually a way that we can relate these two things. It's not the purpose of the talk to explain how this works, but there is a sort of duality inside this, in these two pictures. So what I want to do today is basically just real briefly review. I mean, some of you you guys are all experts in that, but I will have to set up the notation and the context I'm working with. Then I will talk about basically celestial holography and define objects which are important in this context, so-called celestial currents. And then I will tell you how you can actually see these celestial currents from a purely gravitational phase space approach by defining the BMX fluxes, taking into account some fancy prescription for the charges, and give you the full phase space. So this is based on works with Romain Ruzicconi and also with Kevin Nguyen. So you have seen this expansion many times this week, but this is just to briefly introduce my notation. This is the asymptotic flat spacetime in the sense of Bondi, van der Boom, Messner, and Zachs from the 60s. So the Bondi mass aspect M, you have the angular momentum aspect NZ, and the gravitational shear. You know that the Bondi news is the time derivative of this asymptotic shear, which encodes the fact that you have an isolated system emitting gravitational waves. This wave travels through space-time and reach the boundary of future null infinity. So they are subject to, as also Marc explained yesterday, this is a sort of, now it's a fully fixed gauge approach here, but the Bondi mass and angular momentum aspect are subject to this constraint equation, which govern their time evolution.
Laura, there is a question in the chat.
Yes?
Yeah.
Stefan Poraska is asking what was the reason that spatial infinity was ignored as a possibility for flat space holography?
Well, I think that spatial infinity is a boundary of flat spacetime, but we might be interested in looking at observables in quantum gravity, and the observable in quantum gravity are the S-matrix elements. And this matrix element, I mean, no particle exits at spatial infinity. which doesn't mean that it's not interesting to see how basically what is the asymptotic symmetry structure. It can tell us a lot about actually this antipodal matching condition and so on and so forth, but I think that's basically the reason why they have been some body of works on that, but I think that's basically the reason why. Yes, Massimo. Massimo has a question.
All right.
In the presence of massive particles, you have to consider I plus. So, when you consider only massless particles, then you can restrict to scry I. Also, the formula that you wrote for N, A, and M, of course, are valid if the graviton is the only massless particle. If there are other massless particles like the photon, then there are contributions from matter to the from the massless particles to the variation of M and NA.
Yes, but I think the question was about this place rather than this one. Was I zero? They was asking about why this was not looked at I zero, and I think.
Well, that's another acronym, right? That's ADM. Not BMS. I mean, it's, if you consider charges at I zero, those are the ADM charges.
Yeah, you can define charges, and there have been a body of works showing by Marqueno and others that actually there is a BMS, while it was for a long time thought that there is no an infinite dimensional extension of symmetry there. There is actually one. There is a nice story about pairing and parity condition and smoothness regularity on I zero, and there's a nice I zero is an important place to look at.
Maybe my question is a little bit aside, but why would we consider that the only observables of quantum gravity are S-matrix elements?
Well, what do you have in what other observable would?
Well,
you,
I mean that's in the quantum field theory, maybe there are other things that this is scattering process, and scattering process is usually one aspect of a field theory, not every aspect.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there are other kind of observable one can define, but I don't know how. Yeah, I would be mostly interested in scattering processes, actually, of massless particles for this talk. Okay, thank you for the comments.
Hello, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. There is a question from Lee that actually I think is already unmuted. Lee, can you try to speak?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we live in a universe that doesn't have any asymptotic regions, and I think we need observables inside the universe that can relate to what we observers actually see. And I would propose our backward light cone, that is, to take something like the celestial sphere, but around each of us looking at the information coming from the past to our backward light cone.
Yeah, the sound is not so great, so I'm not sure
yes.
I fully understood the comment. But
can you please try to reformulate the sentence, or worst case,
yes,
if you want?
Yes, I would propose observables for that correspond to observations made by observers inside the universe and not in asymptotic regions. And I think we can construct some by making a construction of observables on the backward light cone.
Okay. Oli is commenting on defining observable in a different location, asymptotic region.
Okay, thank you very much. If there are other questions, please. Or if you want to comment more, Lee, you can also write in the chat, and then I can ask as you prefer. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'm glad there is already discussion at this point. And just to briefly remind you that there has been a bunch of... So now we will be dealing with this asymptotic notion of flat spacetime and the asymptotic symmetries, as Adrien explained on Monday, are symmetry preserving this class of spacetime, and there have been different proposals for what is this group. So the original Bondi-Messner-Zach group is called the global BMS group. this super translation and the globally well-defined Lorentz transformation, the so-called extended BMS group is enhances the Lorentz part to include the full local conformal symmetries on the celestial sphere. So it's two copies of the Witt algebra or Virasoro without center extension, if you want. And in some direction with super translation, the generalized BMS consider rather the full diffeomorphism on the sphere. Now we have also the Weil or W BMS or BMSW group advocated by several people here in this room. So we have a sort of nasty structure of symmetry groups here. And just to tell you that I will be dealing with the so-called extended BMS group. So I will just consider the usual, let's say, super rotation, so meromorphic vector fields on the sphere. Okay. So as we have touched upon in the discussion, I mean, something I will be interested in is the scattering problem in flat spacetime. And remarkably, these BMS symmetries actually constrain the gravitational scattering problem in flat spacetime, as pointed out by Strominger. And I think the two key ingredients are, I will go briefly through that, but is we have to, why this was not noticed before is because we needed to first understand what are another choice for BMS symmetries. As Adrien explained, this is a rather subtle question. And so this is a chart, for instance, for supertranslation symmetry. T is the parameter of supertranslation, M is the bonding mass aspect. And also we need to understand how to, if you want to describe how the in state and out state are related to each other, how the expansion at the past, infinity, and the one at the future are actually talking to each other. And this is what people were asking me about spatial infinity here. And the past of the future is called square plus minus. And similarly, we have the future of the past, square minus plus. And we need to match these the quantities around I0, which looks like a point here, but is actually infinitely far away from these places. And the recent literature have developed this so-called antipodal matching condition, which is telling you how basically the data, the future match as you go along through spatial infinity. And this is a key ingredient into showing that BMS is actually a symmetry of the gravitational S matrix. Okay. Great. So with that, you can actually see that with this matching, you have an infinite amount of conservation laws associated with BMS supertranslation symmetries, and you have another full towers of other symmetries and conservation laws which carry on and which are constraining any scattering process in flat spacetime. And I'm focusing on massless scattering here. Okay, and this led basically to this observation that we have actually different languages. We're talking about the same.
You are in the meeting now.
We have the languages of asymptotic symmetries in GR, the supertranslation symmetry. We have actually the statement that BMS symmetries are constrained by S matrix is one-to-one with the so-called soft theorem in quantum field theory. And we have remarkably some prospects for measuring the BMS, the imprint of BMS on, say, a black hole merger. So this is the signal that you would get from the displacement memory at a gravitational wave detector. So I'm going very fast on that. I assume most of you have heard these things before. Now, let me move. Is there any question on that? Or comments? No? If not, let me go through this celestial holography paradigm that Anna and others have been exposing to us earlier this week. So basically, the idea, as I said, would be to consider the celestial sphere, which is the sphere at infinity, as playing the role of the holographic, where the holographic dual is formulated. So the idea is to recast a scattering element into a different form through this integral, which is the so-called Mellin transform. I will go in more detail a bit, explain what this is, why you consider that. But basically, the idea is to try to take this idea seriously and to see where it can lead us when we want to basically reconsider scattering elements in terms of reinterpret this as some correlation function. So this is supposed to be a correlation function with a bound of operators inserted at the given point Z and Z bar on the celestial sphere, which carry some quantum numbers, their conformal dimension delta, and a 2D spin J. So the idea is that each massless particle is represented by an operator. Each massless enters or crosses or exits spacetime at a given point, Z and Z bar, and will be represented by this operator on the celestial sphere. So how does this work? Well, basically, this is the power of the Mellin transform. Somehow, if you look at plane wave packets of representing a massless particle, here is the usual plane waves representation. Then if you perform this Mellin transform, this will map plane wave to a different object, which is called conformal primary wave functions. Why is it called so? Just because you can see that the action of SL2C, or the global conformal transformation, or the Möbius action, if you want, on this object is basically the transformation law for a primary, a quasi-primary, in a usual CFT language. So notice that what is going on here is that you have the massless plane wave carries an energy omega, and the Mellin transform trades the energy for this conformal dimension delta, which equivalently is usually written as the sum of left and right weights, h and h bar. So sometimes I write delta, sometimes h and h bar. It's the same information. And so you have this nice, basically now you're trading the nice transformation rule under translation to now a nicer picture in terms of SL2C transformation, where this transformation becomes more manifest. This just what's going on here. This is for a scalar, but you have a spinning particle. It carries a four-dimensional helicity, epsilon mu. And this helicity is identified with the 2D spin in the conformal theory. Is just identifying with J. Okay? So with that, you can define the celestial operators. Well, basically, this is a bit redundant statement, but by taking any bulk operator that depends on any point in the bulk, take a Klein-Gödel product pushed at null infinity with this conformal primary wave function. So recall this psi delta is just the Mellin transform of the plane wave. And so since this guy transforms as a primary, it will the transformation law for this O delta will carry through, and this will also transform as quasi-primary on the celestial sphere. So let me repeat again what's going on, so in a different way. So just to tell you that it's very simple what's going on, it's just this is a standard textbook formula for how you expand the field in terms of plane wave packets and creation annihilation operators. In the usual momentum basis, where you have this momentum P, on-shell null momentum, and so you can just rewrite this using a parametrization. You have three variables. You can trade them for this, the energy and the point, W bar, Z and Z bar, if you want, at which the massless particle is heading to on null infinity. So this is just a rewriting. And now what you do in the celestial basis, you expand this operator, but now what you do is you take the plane waves, you do the inverse Mellin transform, and expand now in terms of no longer plane wave, but these conformal primary wave functions. Okay?
Laura.
And similarly, the usual ladder operators are traded for the Mellin transform of ladder operator A delta. Yes?
We have a question from the chat from Rukaya. She's asking whether the transition from the holographic basis to the SL2C, what is the group in the holographic basis? This is the question.
What's the group in the? What's the group?
Rukaya, do you want to unmute yourself and try to ask the question, reformulate your question, maybe?
So you have the Lorentz transformation in the bulk, and then you rewrite this in the new basis in a way that before you had the plane wave make the translation symmetry manifest, and the SL2C transformation obscure. Now it's a bit the other way around. So that's just what's going on. It's the same transformation as before. It's just a basis that makes this or that action more manifest.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Other comments, questions? No? All right, great. So basically, this what do we call the celestial operators? Okay, here I'm just talking about the scalar version. If you have spin in particles, it's a bit more involved than that, but roughly speaking, the same way that you can extract the creation or annihilation operator by taking the Klein-Gorlow inner product of this phi and plane waves, then you can extract a celestial operator by taking this kind of inner product now with the conformal primary wave functions. And this we will call that an operator on the celestial sphere, curly O delta. And here it is for scalars, so it's spin zero, but you have similar objects for spin one and two. Okay. So the nice thing about that is that precisely these things transform as primaries with these weights. And now something I want to emphasize today is the fact that you can get currents in the usual CFT by taking the so-called conformally soft limits. Conformally soft limits is, if you want, the dual notion of what is an energetically soft limit. So in a usual soft limit is taking the energy omega of a particle to go to zero. Now in this new basis, it's actually, you can see that the analog version of the soft limit now will amount to take integer values of the conformal dimension delta. So just as an example, consider QED and take delta, the limit, the conformally soft limit, delta goes to one. Then you will be able to get an object which is transformed as 1 comma 0. So this notation just means h is 1 and h bar is 0. So again, h and h bar related to delta and j like that. And this is a usual U1 Kaczmodi current. This is the usual wire identity of a U1 Kaczmodi current in the two-dimensional conformal field theory. And actually, this expression is nothing but another way of rewriting something that was known for a long time, which is the Weinberg soft photon theorem. For gravity, the story is even more interesting because the conformally soft limit delta goes to 1 gives you another object which is tied to the support translation symmetries. Actually, what you have to do is not quite take or consider this object, which is a 3/2, 1/2, because delta is 1 and j is 2. You have to take a descendant of this object, which increases the h bar by 1 unit. Sorry, this was a minus a half, and then you get a plus a half. And this is what is called a super translation current, and it has this sort of, it obeys this sort of operator product expansion in celestial CFT. Which again is related, is nothing but the Weinberg's leading soft graviton theorem. And you can see that it has this funny fact of shifting the conformal weights that we have seen, heard in the previous talk by 1 unit. Remarkably, there is an object which is a 2,0, as we are used to in CFT, and is satisfied the usual wire identity of a stress tensor. So how it's built out of the phase space, I will go to that later on. But this is the usual wire identity of a stress tensor. So this means that the existence of this stress tensor promotes the celestial operator, which before I told you they were quasi-primary. But now the existence of that actually is telling you that these objects are full Virazoro primary on the celestial sphere. So that's the summary so far. This is the celestial holography picture. The soft sector of this is given by currents, which are obtained by integer values of the conformal dimension delta. Now, let me move on to the core of this talk, which I realize that Céline will kill me because not only we started late, but also I had some questions, but don't worry, I will. Yes, yes. I prefer that. I will skip stuff if we don't have time. But.
This is about the whole chapter number two. Actually, when you make this transformation, you go from these ladder operators defined in the usual basis to those that you have defined through this integral. Well, that precisely, thank you. Is there an interpretation of those, you know, as coherent states, or I don't know how this could be interpreted?
Because an interpretation start, of what, Mario? Sorry.
The interpretation of these new ladder operators that you have.
These ones, yeah.
I mean, do you have an interpretation? I mean, an interpretation of the sort of coherent state.
That's a good question. I don't know any of that, but maybe some people have thought of that. I mean, if someone knows about that, let me know. But yeah.
They're linear. Whereas it's not the usual notion of coherent state.
Yeah, what would become this notion in these ways?
But it is a superposition.
Yeah, this superposes all energies. That's for sure. But maybe there is a. All right. Okay, so that was the celestial holography part. Now you can forget everything, and then let's start again from zero, and go back to this Bondi expansion that. That some of you are very familiar with, and define BM as fluxes. So, because you see, I'm trying to do holography, I'm trying to define things that look like conformal primaries, but here, where are the primaries in this story? I mean, which objects are actually primaries? How does this even make sense? Because when you look at the transformation rule of the shear, the news, and so on, then you don't recognize any naively any conformal transformations, that look like a transformation of a primary in a CFT. So this is what I want to address. Is basically how to answer this question. So by the way, I will be working from now with I will flatten the sphere, so all my covariant derivative will be just the normal derivative. T, I recall, is the super translation parameter, y and y bar, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic super rotations. So these are my symmetry generators. Okay. So, and then how are they related to the things I've been telling you before? So the super translation and the stress tensor. So to answer this question, we need first to talk about charges. And Romain already gave you basically this expression earlier this week. So as we know, BMS charges are not conserved. There are some outgoing radiation. And to extract a meaningful part prescription for these BMS charges, we need a bunch of work. So many people in this room have contributed to this expression, which I think is the up-to-date expression for a prescription for the charges. So you can see that the BMS charge is the pairing between the transsymmetry parameters, T, Y, and Y bar, and these curly things here in blue. So you can see that M is not exactly they are not exactly the mass aspect, the angular momentum aspect. There are some fancy decoration on them. And if you think that is ugly, well, you can go in Newman-Penrose formalism, and they take a much nicer form in this language. So this is the prescription I will be working with. And of course, we have this non-conservation of the charges because of the fluxes going through. And the fluxes are, we'll define them as some integration over the retarded time of these charges. So this is just a definition of what I call the super momentum flux. So you can see it's just the integral over u of d by du of the curly m. This is the super momentum flux. and the super angular momentum flux is the same story, but related to the mass, to the angular momentum aspect. Okay. So we have the BMS fluxes. So basically, the charge is not conserved, but rather is. But there is a controlled way of understanding this non-conservation. And now an important fact that was worked out originally by Glenn and Romain was the understanding that actually these objects are primary fields under the action of the extended BMS group. So this is something you can check, that this curly P here is actually three half primary, has a transformation law of a primary field. So this is my convention for the weights here. This is, I think, a standard textbook CFT convention. So you can see that this case is three half, and this curly J is a 2.1 primary. Yes, Andrea. The integral is important. The integral is important. Because you need some integration by parts sometimes, and
okay. So without the integral, so the curly M does not transform as a primary.
No.
Okay. Thanks.
And Laura, what about the two last term in the second line? Are they important?
These things?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They are very important for the following. So indeed, the if you want the conformal transformation piece that we are used to in CFT is this kind of things. But the structure of the BMS group, it's really forcing you to have this transformation, this extra transformation for the angular momentum under the action of translation.
It's the semi-direct structure of BMS.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you will see that it has an implication on the stress tensor of celestial CFT. Good. So, tell me when I will need to start, because now I'm confused with the... Okay. So this was the first question I asked, and this is the answer. The BMS fluxes are primaries on the celestial sphere of these weights. And we want to go further, understand whether they close an algebra and what this algebra has to do with the celestial operator product expansion, for instance, and the celestial currents. To answer this, we need two things. First is a sort of refined analysis of the radiative phase space in the presence of superrotations. And the second is an important split between what I will call the hard and the soft pieces of these fluxes, such that both of these pieces, the hard and the soft, transform as a primary fields under the extended BMS symmetries. Okay, so let's start with the first point. So we will define, and then this is not new. I mean, now it's been around for a couple of years. The shift in new tensor N tilde is defined so as to stay zero for any vacuum configuration. Because so this is the normal, the usual new tensor. Just, but you can see that it has an inhomogeneous piece in this transformation under superrotation, meaning that if you start with n with being zero, after you act with the super translation, it will no longer be zero. So it might be interesting to have a notion of news which stays zero after and before you act with superrotation. And this is basically what this n tilde is doing for you. You have to remove this piece, which is called NZZ. Vac, which related to the trace-free part of the Gehrig tensor and has an expression in terms of a Liouville field. There, I, if you are interested in the details, just check this literature. And we need to consider specific fall-off condition at the corners of scry when you go to plus or minus infinity. And this is the fall-off condition I will be considering. So in particular, you can see that the shear takes, so this is an expression valid when u goes to plus or minus infinity. When it's plus, you can see that the value of the shear at scry++ will involve the Goldstone mode, C plus, so this is the value of the super translation field at scry plus plus, and you have another value here at scry plus minus. So this is what I will call C plus and C minus. And so if you want, is the Goldstone mode associated to the breaking of super translation. And an important remark is that these fall-off conditions do not include interesting, potentially interesting setup, such as the presence of gravitational tails. So for that, you will have to relax this fall-off condition, and this is somehow the framework I'm interested in is this one at the moment. Now, let me just finish with definitions, but you see we have a shifted news that there is an associated shifted shear here, C tilde. And this C tilde involves these objects, the distancer C0, which is, if you are familiar with this literature, is just the two derivative of this Goldstone mode, modulo the fact that actually I'm working with this so-called super-rotation covariant derivative. So I don't want to enter too much in the technicalities, but this has been considered in other papers, and it involves, this phi is the Liouville field, which is an imprint of this NAB vac here. But just to tell you that what does this derivative for you, if you start with the primary of weight h and h bar, if you act with this curly d, it will give you a new primary, but now with weight h plus 1. Okay, and you have an analogous d bar derivative, which increases this h bar weight. But this is basically what it's doing for you. Okay? Good, now we have everything we need. So, as I think Anna, Laurent, and others have introduced this object earlier this week, the leading and the subleading soft graviton operators are actually these U integrate transform. Actually, they have a full towers of that with different powers of U here, but I'm just focusing on the first of this tower. So they are defined like that here. Notice that we have this NAB vac subtlety that we are accounting for. Now let's talk about symplectic structure. So the symplectic structure will be split into a soft and hard piece. I will go back to that later on. But this is the hard piece of the symplectic structure. You might recognize a familiar form from Ashtekar, but now there is a tilde on top of the quantities. So this is they belong to the hard sector of the phase space, these tilde things. And this is just a reminder for you what these things are. And the soft piece takes this actually very nice form. So you can see that the quantities that belong to the soft phase space are, on the one hand, this leading and subleading soft graviton operator, curly n. Curly n zero here. And this pi is actually a combination of these two guys. And the symplectic partner of these objects are these C0 here, which again is the two derivatives of the Goldstone mode, and this NAB, NZ, and NVAC tensor here. So I think now this is the... this was extensively studied by Miguel Campillian and Alok Lada. We have revisited this a bit, what he's telling you is that you have a very full understanding now of what is the phase space for in the presence of superrotation, and it's basically telling you, these brackets are just telling you the same, that I mean that these guys are a symplectic pair with each other, and the symplectic partner of this and vac is this quantity here. And C is the average of the Goldstone, the future and the past. So this is, a nice rewriting of the symplectic structure. Notice that it can be related to the symplectic structure of Ashtekar and Strobel. Actually, the difference is just a corner term. Even by that, so it's the difference can be nicely repackaged in terms of this corner term. Good, and so now there is a very good understanding of this phase space, and related to that, it allows us basically to extract the right candidates for the fluxes with, and the primaries in celestial holography. So the hard piece is, as usual in this language, is basically quadratic into the new tensor. And the soft piece is basically is coincide if you are familiar with Strominger literature, but now there is some decoration, but basically it's 2 times the derivative of the leading soft graviton theorem. And what I really want to emphasize is that all this fancy prescription is made in such a way that both of these guys transform separately as primary fields under the extended BMS group. So, actually, these hard and soft moment are related, of course, to the have an associated flux. And you can check that the associated flux generate the transformation on the radiative space, phase space. So you have a soft sector and a hard sector. So the guys in the hard sector don't transform under the action of the soft stuff and vice versa. So these are very nice relationship. And notice that you can actually obtain or check that these fluxes, both the soft and hard, can be obtained from the symplectic by contracting the symplectic structure with the Hamiltonian vector field that generate here super translations. And there is a similar story for super rotation. Is there any question or comment, Massimo?
Just to clarify, when you pass from the integral in DU to the integral over the celestial sphere, are you assuming that nothing passes through I plus, that there are no massive particles? Or
so I'm assuming a specific fall-off condition as I'm approaching I plus, which I went through pretty fast, but this is the thing that I'm considering, which is important indeed to make integrations and stuff. So yeah. All right, good. So, great. So this is the story associated to super translation. Now, what about super rotations? And what about, I forgot to say, but this is an important thing that we needed to use in the first paper with Romain. And it was a sort of conjecture in this paper. But now it's really proven that the soft and the hard pieces of the flux really factorize each other, and this actually was important for the experts in the room who know what I'm talking about. And what about the super translation? Karen, you remember before I told you that you have insertion in the celestial sphere had this funny effect on shifting the weights? Well, basically, you can relate this straight P here with this curly P here by taking a derivative. So here we are working with this fancy derivative stuff. So basically, you can consider this as some of a descendant, and there has been a different way of seeing that by Sabrina and others. But basically, this is a relationship between the celestial currents and the supermomentum flux. So I think now we have really an understanding of how these objects in the celestial sphere are related to the usual BMS phase space. Well, extended a bit. Okay, that's for super translation. Now we have also super rotations, and we have everything that I said for super translation carry through. Mutatis mutandis for a super rotation case. Now we have an object which is a 2,1. Okay, this is the super angular momentum flux, J here J bar, but there is a J piece, of course, which is a 1,2. So this is the expression, and again, we have the fact that the transformation rule follow, and so on and so forth. We had the factorization between the soft and the hard piece. We can check that the symplectic structure I showed before give you this exactly these soft plugs, which before in this paper were sort of guessed, but now we have a really constructive way of getting at these expressions. Good. So now you may wonder, OK, why am I bothering into all this fancy decoration of these? And I want to tell you that there is actually a physical thing associated to this correction. And to do that, let me first tell you that you remember before I told you there is a 2,0 in celestial safety. There is a sort of stress tensor. Well, there is something that has the wire identity of a stress tensor in a conventional CFT. And it's obtained from this curly J bar. So how do you go from something which is 2,1 to something which is 2,0? Well, you need to get rid of one of the thing on the right. So you need to, you can do that by making this contour integral to get something which transforms as a 2,0. So basically, this T bar is this integral of the soft part of the J. Okay, so this is just the same thing, but now I'm integrated over W so that I get 2,0. So this is where the stress tensor comes from. And for those who are familiar with this literature, this is this expression, so three derivative of the subleading soft graviton operator, is the expression that was obtained some time ago by Anna and others from reverse engineer of the subleading soft graviton theorem. So except that here we have this, again, we have this fancy derivative here, but basically this is their expression. So this is not, I mean all this, of course. But now you see we have corrections to this. So these are new quadratic corrections to the stress tensor. And you might wonder why this correction mean, and they have a very nice interpretation, these new quadratic pieces. Actually, they exactly account for the one loop correction of the subleading soft theorem of Kacheso-Strominger, subleading soft graviton theorem. So the correction, the one loop correction of the subleading soft graviton theorem was computed by amplitude people by Zwickburn and collaborator. And basically, what you can remarkably show is that, so you know, there is this always this story of if you have a soft theorem, it has to do with a wire identity associated to a symmetry and to insertion of some operator. And you can see that the insertion of this operator, which is, again, obtained from a purely classical way, actually accounts for the loop correction. So you can say, OK, well, how can that even work? Where is there is no H bar here. So how can I get any correction to the soft theorem loop correction here? But actually, the H bar is not here. So before, there was the guess of the stress tensor, which some H bar in this. But here I want to stress that there is no H bar in the expression for the stress tensor. But nevertheless, insertion of this stress tensor in the scattering element gives you the loop correction. This has to do with the fact that the two-point function of the Goldstone mode here has an H bar in it. So there, I'm just telling you this. You can check out the detail how this works. This is a nice result about this new quadratic pieces. Let me now mention, however, that there has been some works by Cacheso and others. There is some subtlety, apparently, whether or not there's some discussion of whether there is some loop correction for the subleading subgraviton theorem. It has to do with some order limiting commuting, or whether you take the soft limit first before you take the expansion, the dimensional regulator, and or the other way around. But in any case, I cannot really comment more on that. But let me say that in any case, what it means is that since anyway, either it's not corrected or it's one loop exact, as it was shown by these guys, it means that the superrotation are indeed the general symmetries of the gravitation S matrix beyond semi-classical level. So now we are on the farm. We are sure about that. So I'm closing, I'm wrapping up here by just showing you that you might wonder what is a stress tensor, and the obvious question is, what is the central charge of this stress tensor? And remarkably, the BMS flux algebra give you the OPEs in the celestial sphere, actually. And you can read off from this OPE that the central charge is zero. Now the story is more complicated than that. There is other notion of stress tensor in celestial CFT. I don't want to enter into all that. Probably Sabrina also will comment on that later today. She has a different take on that. So this is anyway what we get from this analysis. So I'm concluding. So I wanted to emphasize again today that doing flat space holography requires us to go beyond what we know from EDS. We have to deal with this flux of radiation, and we have infinitely many constraints, actually an infinite amount of infinite hours of stuff to deal with. So it's very exciting to see how we can actually try to extend the holographic paradigms to account for these new symmetries, which have no analog in usual holography. A key perspective one might have is the one I tried to emphasize today, was the one on this object, which are the BMS fluxes, as they give the primary fields, celestial operator products expansion, and so on. And yeah, of course, I mean, there are many big questions in this program that that are under the investigation. Of course, we have to answer at some point the question of what is a celestial conformal field theory, or in the other picture, what is a conformal Carolian conformal field theory. We don't know yet. There are many puzzling things, but we are also making a lot of progress. And can we get some top-down construction? And Charles will tell us about that today. He has a nice top-down approach in lower dimension. So I'm done, and I just want to finish by saying that everything I touch upon basically has deep connection with other communities. I'm thinking of mathematical GR community and nice works on stability theorem, peeling or not peeling. There are also a bunch of very interesting works on amplitude. People are looking at also, post-Newtonian, post-Minkowskian approach. Conformal field theory technique, of course, bootstrap. Gravitational wave observation is tightly connected to this story by the memory effects and other. There is a nice deep picture coming from twister theory, which is very old and actually is really showing up everywhere in this place. We have nice construction by Penrose that we cannot ignore somehow, the nonlinear graviton thing, stuff, many things I don't understand, but I think that we should make contact with. Of course, we are from classical GR perspective, but there is also quantum field theory approach, loop correction, there are log correction to soft theorems. Basically, it involves all this sort of stuff, and also there is a nice fluid gravity approach, which I think we should also be able to incorporate into all that, the membrane paradigm, and so on and so forth. So I think that basically we'll make progress in quantum gravity by joining forces and talking to all other communities. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Laura. We have time for a couple of questions.
Yes. What are these amplitudes? So if you want to tell an experimentalist, observe this, right? If you have amplitudes written in the momentum basis, presumably you are just looking at initial and final momenta, other quantum numbers of particles. What would I compute if I wanted to compare with these amplitudes, with the amplitudes written in the conformal basis? I mean, I could always do a Mellin transform, but in themselves, do they have any meaning?
You mean, can we directly probe celestial amplitude? That's a great question. Experimental said the word to.
Yeah, because you know, as you know, if experimentalists, if you tell them that differs by a comma, they don't listen to you. So you have to translate everything exactly in their language, like in LIGO. So. It would be interesting to see what if there is any meaning. For the stress energy tensor, for instance, you may think that you are measuring the total energy in a beam, right? When you compute the T at some point C. But I wonder if you thought about this question.
Not personally, maybe Anna has, I don't know. Laurent has a comment, but I mean, yeah.
You can think of the conformal dimension as the momenta for a Rindler observer. So, you know, if your particle physicist was accelerating, that's what he would measure.
We have a question by Simone.
Yes, sorry, if you can comment or explain again, you said you wanted to, you needed to modify the Ashtiga-Streubel symplectic form by a corner term, and I was wondering, does this change also the definition of the charges? And can you, if so, can you repeat why is the reason to modify the definition of the charges?
Yeah. So it will. It will change. But the logic we had was to start from this BMS charge prescription. So this prescription has a couple of important features which I didn't go through, but basically some of the key thing about that is that so they are defined as a constant at a cut, at a U cut, and they, of course, this the way how you define is you need to tell me which properties you want to define these charges in such this or that way. So the prescription here is that. Basically, these charges vanish when there is no radiation. Even, when any vacuum configuration, they will stay zero. They are zero in the absence of radiation. And also an important aspect is that they close at the corner of Scry with the standard Lie bracket. So this is boils down to the nice work of Romain, Adrien, Geoffrey. So this is the prescription, and everything follows from there if you want. And this is what gives you the symplectic structure and this little pieces, this little decoration compared to the Ashtiga verbal one.
Yeah, we have to cut, unfortunately. We're running out of time. I'm sorry. Let's thank Laura again.
Thank you.